This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello there. Welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn. In today's 2011 in review edition of the program, we'll go to London to find out about all the real estate the now deposed dictators of North Africa bought there. We'll go to Belgrade to pay a visit to the Serbian royal family. We'll go to Berlin to find out how a model with rather unconventional looks gets so much work.
The concept of being a Calvin Klein model is just a shock. So the people look twice, like, who is that? Rather than have a blank, boring Kate Mossy type model that looks like all the other models, you know.
And we'll even take you to the Romanian countryside for a visit with a group of shepherds. All those stories and much, much more coming up on the program. We'll begin our look back at 2011 in London. Why? Because it gives us a way to look at perhaps the year's biggest story of all, the Arab Spring, from a unique European perspective. The likes of Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, Egypt's Hosni Mubarak, and Tunisia's Zine El Abidine Ben Ali were thrown from power this year. But during their long, long reigns, they and their families amassed some pretty tidy fortunes. And no self-respecting Middle Eastern despot's real estate collection was complete without a townhouse in Kensington. Our reporter Stephen Beard, accompanied by a specialist in high-end properties in London, took a closer look at some of this ill-gotten real estate.
Hello? Hello, is there anyone there?
No one's at home at number 28 Wilton Place in Belgravia. At least no one's answering the door. Not surprising, perhaps. This five-storey townhouse belongs to Gamal Mubarak, son of the ousted Egyptian dictator. My expert on upscale London property is William Green. William, what do you think?
This is a gem of a house, Stephen. It's a Georgian property, double-fronted. It's got a wrought-iron balcony to what will be a first-floor drawing room, which will have probably 12, 15-foot high ceilings, be very formally laid out.
How much is this one worth, do you think?
A freehold property in this neck of the woods is going to be nudging the £15 million mark, I suspect.
£15 million or $22, $23 million?
Very likely.
We've now come about 5 miles north to another immensely expensive neighbourhood. We're on a tiny road called Winnington Close, standing in front of another property fit for a dictator or a dictator's son. This one belongs to Saif Gaddafi.
Well, this is a beautiful house. It's got an in-and-out drive. It's a double-fronted neo-Georgian residence.
And it has some pretty luxurious facilities.
You have a private cinema. I gather this one is suede lined. I believe there's a swimming pool as well and a jacuzzi.
Gaddafi Jr. put this mansion on the market last month for £11 million or $18 million. But it may prove a bit difficult to sell. It's now been occupied by protesters. Rather shy ones. Faces appear at the window, but they're reluctant to speak to me.
Hello? Could I have a word with somebody? Can you open the front door?
They won't let me in, but after half an hour, one of the protesters comes out. He says he's Belkacem Algeriani and that he and his friends are Libyans. Why are you occupying the property? What point are you trying to make?
We are just here to make sure this house go back to the Libyan people, which this house belonged to.
Are you enjoying the facilities? Have you used the jacuzzi yet?
No, we didn't allow even us to use all these things. Only what is necessary, like the toilet or the kitchen.
What about the cinema?
No.
And the swimming pool?
Not to enjoy. We're not having a party. We are here to look after.
None of the permanent residents in this district that I approached wanted to comment on their neighbour, Mr. Gaddafi, except one, Israeli-born writer Saul Zadka.
How do you feel, then, about having Saif Gaddafi as a neighbour?
I'm a bit uncomfortable to live next door to the mass murderer or a serial killer.
But that is one of the perils of living in London, it seems. Britain has a long history as a place of political refuge. Asylum seekers flock here from all over the world. But slack immigration controls mean that some less than reputable characters have wound up in the British capital, and some extremely rich ones. In this financial centre, the wealthy always seem to be welcome, almost regardless of how they acquired that wealth. Anthea Lawson is with the anti-corruption group Global Witness. She says she deplores the way Britain turns a blind eye to ill-gotten gains.
This is stolen money. It's money stolen from the state, often in poor countries, and that has an impact on people's life chances because that's money which should be paying for education and healthcare. I don't think we really want to be promoting London as the sort of financial centre that is building its success on stolen money.
Back in North London, resident Saul Zadka resents the large number of African despots, Arab dictators and Russian mafiosi that live in luxury in his neighbourhood. We drive along the nearby Bishop's Avenue, often called Billionaire's Row.
And as you could see from all the number of cranes on both sides of the street, that they are still in the process of expanding.
More dictators on the way, perhaps.
Yeah, I know. I mean, and I think that the British are in love with dictators. They like the lavishness and the outrageous lifestyle of dictators. There is something mesmerizing.
He says the dictators may lie low here for a while. The government may freeze a few of their assets, but it won't be long before they're back, openly enjoying their ill-gotten real estate in the British capital. Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
Now, many of your strongest memories of London in 2011 may well be of the royal wedding back in April, in which Prince William married Kate Middleton. Or you may be more like me and have skipped the whole thing in the first place, but no matter. A lot of folks love the royals. Many a gossip magazine is kept afloat by them almost entirely. And if you're one of those royal watchers, we've got a special treat for you. An exclusive audience with the Crown Prince and Princess of Serbia. Yeah, there's a Serbian royal family. They lived in exile in London, where else, for decades. But they moved back to Serbia for good in 2001 and were good enough to share some of their memories with our own Mark Lowen in Belgrade.
I'm coming in through the very heavy, enormous engraved iron doors up the red carpet into the heart of the royal palace.
So this palace was commissioned by my grandfather, King Alexander of Yugoslavia, and it was finished in 1929. I was stripped of my nationality when I was 2 years old. I must have been very dangerous at the age of two.
My husband might have physically not been here, but mentally he was always with the people like his father was.
Surrounded by 4,000 square meters of grounds in Belgrade lies the sumptuous royal palace. It was built in the 1920s for the then king of Serbs, Croats and Slovenes, the country that was soon renamed Yugoslavia. When the Nazi-led Axis powers invaded in 1941, King Peter II was forced into exile in London. There his son, Alexander II, was born, who was able to return to this palace just 10 years ago.
Well, I was born in London in Claridge's Hotel, and Churchill was good enough to turn the suite into Yugoslav territory.
So it was declared Yugoslav soil for one day?
One day, yes.
Fantastic.
Amazing story. I was baptised at Westminster Abbey, and my godmother was today's Queen, Queen Elizabeth.
So in 1945, when the war ended, did your father expect to be able to return here relatively quickly?
He was dreaming to come back home, and I think this is what killed him. He really expected that things would settle down and that Yugoslavia would become a democracy and that everybody would get on with each other.
But as Yugoslavia began over four decades of communist rule, mainly under Josip Broz Tito, the royal family were barred from returning and stripped of their Yugoslav nationality.
I did not feel any resentment or revenge. And when we came back here, my wife and I have said we're here for everybody, regardless of what happened in the past. We'd like to move on, and we'd like to see a great democracy come out of the mess.
Crown Prince Alexander and his wife, Princess Catherine, returned first to Belgrade in 1991. But they didn't stay as Yugoslavia began its devastating collapse into civil war, with Slovenia, Croatia and then Bosnia breaking away from Slobodan Milosevic's Yugoslavia. The royal couple returned for good in 2001 after Milosevic was overthrown.
This room, the first room as you come down the steps, is a replica of Ivan the Terrible's throne room in the Kremlin.
Before leaving, the Crown Prince takes me on a tour of the ornate palace.
When my grandfather built the place, he didn't want the kitchen in the building, and the kitchen is about 90 yards away at the bottom of a tunnel.
Right. And the tunnel's still open now, still operational.
Yeah, do you want to see it?
That would be fantastic, yes.
So, at the bottom of this tunnel,
press the
in
buzzer.
The distance there, is okay, the kitchen.
That is amazing. So, it was good exercise being a chef.
Uphill, yeah, to be very fit to bring the food up.
And he tells me of his belief that a constitutional monarchy should be restored to Serbia, with he and his wife as king and queen.
I believe the constitutional monarchy can be a binding point of unity, continuity and stability. What we need is a head of state who's not a member or president of a political party. There's a meeting point.
But in a country that is still finding its democratic identity after decades of wars, occupation and diplomatic isolation, would ordinary Serbs feel ready to embrace constitutional monarchy?
I think that these previous times when the king was here, they were much better, or maybe I'm nostalgic, I don't know.
I like kingdom.
Why do you like it?
I don't know, it's like fairy tale for me. I'm a little princess.
I think the monarchy would be relevant right now because I cannot see anything that it could improve. The president is changeable, but if the monarch gets crazy, then what can you do?
Today, Crown Prince Alexander II is heir to a kingdom that no longer exists, but royalty remains etched into this country's identity. The flag still bears the royal crest, and an older version of the anthem refers to the Serbian king. And so Alexander and Catherine continue to ponder quite what role they will play in steering the now Republic of Serbia away from its turbulent past. Mark Lowen, Deutsche Welle Radio, Belgrade.
I'm Matt Herman in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Welcome back to Inside Europe. This week we're taking another listen to a number of reports from the past year. Some are topical, others you could say are almost timeless. Take this next report on a group of shepherds living in the Romanian countryside, for example. Tom Wilson reports on these families whose lifestyle hasn't changed much in centuries, and who might just offer a few tips on how the rest of us in 2011 or 2012 can live better in harmony with our natural surroundings.
I'm 2,000 metres up in the Buchej Mountains. For 6 months of the year, this mountain plateau is home to 12 shepherds. As well as the 1,000 sheep, there are 134 cows to milk, pigs to look after, and dogs to guard all these animals from wolves and bears. Nelu, the head of the shepherds, is 45. He's bustling in and out of the stunna, the low wooden shed where the shepherds eat and sleep. He's wearing a traditional bell-shaped Romanian hat, a clop perched on his head and a tattered waistcoat. He tells me what a typical shepherd's day looks like.
The sun comes up at 6:30, but by 4 we're already up, milking. Once we finish milking, then we eat. Then we take the animals out to graze. Some people make cheese, others look after the animals, and everyone returns at 4 o'clock.
Then, all through the evening, there's more work to be done. The animals need milking again, and there's a lot more cheese to be made. Bebe, one of the shepherds, explains how they manage to milk so many animals.
Each person has cows that they milk. I don't milk his cows, and he doesn't milk mine.
Bebe insists that I have a go myself.
This is working quite well.
Or so I think, until I watch how the professionals do it.
You can just hear the difference there between my rather pathetic milking effort and Bebe's.
Then the milk is taken down to the sheepfold where it's boiled.
Oh, this is the sound of me pouring 20 litres of milk through the muslin and into the cauldron below.
The milk is left to stand, homemade rennet added, and then the milk is gently heated. It's an especially tough life. The diet is pretty limited, with most meals consisting of cheese and slices of polenta, and maybe a little soup. Up here in the mountains, they also have to face attacks on the sheep by bears and wolves. And being away for 6 months each year, it also seems to take its toll on family life.
I have three children. My wife ran off. She went to the devil. They've grown up. The oldest is 17. They come to see me. Our boss brings them up in his car. They come and stay with me at home. My ex-mother-in-law looks after them now. I have to pay the maintenance every month.
I ask Nelu how people manage to cope with such a tough existence.
It depends on your constitution. Some people can take it, others can't.
I find Thomas sat on a traditional one-legged stool, milking. He wears brown overalls secured with a string belt. I ask him if he doesn't sometimes get sick of it all.
What can we do, though? Die? It's a tough profession, very tough. It's always raining. You get wet and cold. But that's what the job's like.
It turns out that many of them are actually related.
We're like family. The boy who just left with the sheep, he's my cousin. We're five cousins here.
Thomas is 58. He's one of the oldest men here and has never known a different way of life.
From father to son, we've had this profession, looking after animals. I was 6 years old when my father took me with him to look after the cows. I can still remember it today.
Gheorghe has a similar story.
I've done this ever since I was 12. My parents had lots of children, and there were no jobs for us and not much money, so we had to. But I like it. It's something I've liked ever since I was young.
I ask Nicu if things didn't change when the communists took power in Romania after the Second World War.
There was never collectivization here. Okay, we weren't allowed to slaughter calves. We had to give them to the state. But how it is now, that's how it's always been here.
Unlike most farms in the West, here in the sheepfold, everything is 100% organic. They don't use antibiotics and instead use herbal and natural remedies. It's undoubtedly a tough existence, but it's a stark contrast to the mechanised, chemical-intensive farming methods that you find in the developed world. You can't help thinking that perhaps we might have something to learn from these time-honoured methods. Tom Wilson, Deutsche Welle, Romania.
Sie ist ein Model und sie sieht gut aus. She's a model and she looks good. Plainly put from Kraftwerk there. And it's almost a given that if you're a model, you're professionally good-looking, so to speak. Well, at least one agency in Berlin is taking precisely the opposite tack. We ran this story for the first time back in January, around the time of Berlin Fashion Week, and thought it would be just a shame not to hear it again. Here's Neil Leitolis with this report on the Misfit Models Agency. I believe in miracles. Where you
from? You sexy thing, you. Beauty, as the saying goes, is in the eye of the beholder. And standing here on one of Berlin's busiest squares, Alexanderplatz, there frankly aren't that many people I would necessarily call beautiful. But one man in the city would see model potential in virtually everyone here.
He's called Dell and has made a name for himself working as, to put it bluntly, an ugly model. Well, right now he's over in the Alexa shopping centre in a well-known fashion store, and he's not especially happy about the poster models there.
They all look the same. You see them on the street, you would never recognise them because they all look the same. It's for sheep, people that follow the herd, follow the tribe mentality and all that. I'm an individual and I don't follow no herds and do my own thing. It's okay for some people if they want to belong, but not everyone wants to.
Making an individual statement is something which Dell has done since his career as a model started more than 10 years ago. It was his unconventional looks which attracted the eye of a photographer on the streets of London where he's from. Dell signed up with the agency Ugly Models, where he landed high-profile jobs with Calvin Klein, Levi's and Diesel. But while his unusual face has made his fortune, it does rather sound like he's playing a role in a 20th century version of a Victorian freak show.
No, I don't think that at all, because the way I see it, they pay me money. Who's the idiot? Then me or them? With the concepts of being a Calvin Klein model, it's just a shock. So people look twice, like, who is that? Rather than have a blank, boring Kate Mossy type model that looks like all the other models, you know.
Dell's high-profile modelling jobs even caught the eye of star photographer David Bailey. But Dell, in his self-deprecating way, explains how an offer from the master of photography came to nothing.
David Bailey says, can I take a picture of you naked and I'll give you a picture and it'll be worth £10,000? I just said to my agent, would you buy a naked picture of me for £10,000? The phone was quiet for a bit. You're beautiful.
You're beautiful, it's true. Dell, who now lives in Berlin, noticed a lack of interesting and realistic faces in the fashion business and set up his own agency, Misfit Models, to fill this gap. But what kind of people does he look for?
Character faces, be it big or small, fat, skinny, black, white. Characters look like thugs, boxers, gangsters, to little old ladies knitting. But the thing they have to have, all of them, is confidence in their own body and to be flexible for work.
One person who is certainly qualified to be a misfit model is Heiko Mersch. When he's not working as a customer services agent for German airline Lufthansa, he's either being photographed for fashion magazines or appearing in movies like Inglourious Basterds and Valkyrie. A collapsing balcony severed his leg when he was just 7 years old, but he's turned what many would regard as a handicap into a unique selling point.
I never thought of being a model because when I was younger, I was too small and I was not good-looking enough for being a model. I got two legs when I was little, but not for a long time because, you know, then I lost it. And I thought, why not do something positive out of it? You can do so many things and it's nothing really that handicaps me. I work for movies, Quentin Tarantino and Tom Cruise. I was always playing the bad Nazi, the German soldier who lost legs, you know, and a few modeling jobs for small fashion labels in Berlin, for Rimmel London. Then I worked once for Vivienne Westwood.
As Dell and Heiko look forward to more successful jobs, they're proof that you don't have to have conventional Hollywood good looks to make it in the modeling business. And for all of you out there who, like me, might dread looking in the mirror each morning, the guys have some words of advice.
Don't look in the mirror. Don't look and think about what other people say about you, because everybody has something very special. And if you have a look in the magazines, the people in the magazines are not real. They're fake. So if you have something special to show, just be proud of it and live your life and try to do the best out of it and not look what other people say.
Can I swear?
Not really.
All right. Stop being a couch potato and get out there and be yourself. Don't worry about what others think of you, as long as you're not upsetting other people. Do it. Live your life. Don't sit there watching TV or surfing on the internet. Get out there and live life and enjoy it.
Neil Aitolis, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin. You are beautiful.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Matt Herman in Bonn. For more news and information, do visit our website, dw-world.de. There you'll find podcasts of this and many other Deutsche Welle radio programs. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn. In the next half hour, we're going to take you on a visit to Rungis, the world's largest fresh food market that powers the kitchens of Paris's finest restaurants. And we'll tell you about one group in the Netherlands' plans to win people over to another fresh food, bugs.
At first, people started to laugh and it was like a fear factor. But now almost everybody knows you can eat insects. People have to try them and to taste them. And that's what we're really doing, letting them taste them.
All right, I'm up for it. Bring on the grasshoppers. All that and more coming up in the next 30 minutes of Inside Europe. First, we'll take you to Florence, which I don't think you'll mind, considering how many people flock to that city each year. The tourist board there says it's more than 10 million. Many of you end up spending hours in line to see Michelangelo's David at the Accademia Gallery. I've been there, but the city's charms are apparent even in a simple stumble around town. That's down in part to its history as a city of craftsmen. The work of its woodcarvers, stonemasons, furniture makers, sculptors, they surround you. The Florentine craft tradition is a rich one, handed down from generation to generation. But today, there just aren't that many craftsmen, or craftswomen for that matter, left. It's become too hard to make a living from it. Our correspondent Jean DiMarino went to talk to a few of those last remaining holdouts in Florence.
In a small bottega or workshop on Via dei Velluti in Florence, a master bookbinder plies a trade handed down to him through five generations.
My great-great-grandfather started in 1856 with a small stationery store and a small workshop.
Enrico Giannini uses techniques that are centuries old. He binds books in vellum and parchment and embosses them in gold leaf. Every volume is unique. The designs are his own. Each item takes hours of painstaking labour. But the beauty and originality of this work may not be enough to ensure he stays afloat.
Nobody wants now. They don't need the sets. they don't need photo album. There is a digital camera. You can have put everything in your computer. And that's all. So a lot of things are changing.
Over the past few decades alone, hundreds of artisans have fled the city centre. Gold and silversmiths, typographers and printers, stonemasons too. Once it was different. In medieval times, Florence was a beacon for craftsmen. The promise of plentiful commissions drew them from all around Italy and overseas. Forming cooperazioni or trade guilds, they created a city that hummed with productivity. A network of bottega developed in which artists like Brunelleschi and Donatello were trained. Their work made Firenze famous around the world. But today, little of that network remains.
At first, there were 15 or 16 of us restorers in this area. Now, there are just three, including me. They've made this all into houses. It has transformed Florence. It's becoming really ugly for me because there used to be all these workshops before where people could linger and watch. Instead, now it's totally changed.
The master restorer says the economic crisis has also taken its toll on the artisans, affecting both local and international markets for the Florentine goods. Bookbinder Enrico Giannini believes a greater problem may be that we no longer have the taste or the time for beauty.
It's not easy to understand that to bind a book you need 4 or 5 days. So when you ask a price for that, they say, oh, you're crazy. It's cheaper to buy a new one than to rebind the old.
Few today think of purchasing furniture and ornaments for life. Goods are cheap to buy, they last a minute, and are easy to throw away. It's the cost that's king. But a tiny few artisans are managing to survive, even thrive. a due passi or a few steps away, Aldo Santini listens as musicians put their instruments through their paces. Aldo is a luthier. He makes and restores violins, violas and cellos. It's a lucrative business. A restored violin, depending on its maker and state of repair, can fetch up to hundreds of thousands of dollars. As many of the artisans aspire to do, Aldo is successfully carving out a niche for himself overseas.
My clients are most of all dealers from London. The centre of the market in the world for violins is London. There are a lot of auctions and a lot of people make business in the hotels around the auction places.
The concern is, if something doesn't happen soon to prevent it, the artisan's skills, passed down over centuries, acquired over a lifetime, will be lost.
My father was saying the artisans are like a chain. If you lose one piece, it's broken and it can work.
Enrico Giannini says it's now difficult to find tools. The stores where he once bought the pigments for his paint have closed. But the heir of five generations of entrepreneurs is refusing to give up.
This is leather.
Among his many ideas are DVD covers bound in leather, which look just like books.
This is the part of my work which I like, to surprise the customers with something. I love my work also for that, because me too, when I arrive at the end of the work, I say, oh, I'm proud of it. I love it.
Like the artisans throughout history, Enrico Giannini is having to adapt and use ancient skills to find new markets in a changing world. He hopes this and other products he's working on will help him survive in the computer age. For Radio Deutsche Welle, this is Jean Di Marino in Florence.
So Florence's artisans are dwindling in number. Alive and well, on the other hand, is another tradition of handmade craftsmanship in another corner of Europe, Scotland's Harris Tweed. The world-famous woolen fabric is only woven on the Isles of Harris and Lewis in the Outer Hebrides. Since 1846, the islanders have been sharing their wares with the world, and now, for 100 years, they've been protecting it from imitation. If it doesn't bear a little tag with a little unique globe motif, it's not real Harris Tweed. It costs a pretty penny, but many customers decide that it's worth it, not least among them designers like Vivienne Westwood or the sneaker company Nike, both of whom have used the cloth in their designs. Our own Danny Mitzman decided to head out to the Hebrides to see the master fabric makers at work.
A Harris Tweed mill in Carloway on the Isle of Lewis. Everywhere you look, there are bundles of freshly woven cloth and bolts of the washed and pressed finished tweeds. It's a sturdy, water-resistant fabric. After all, it's made from the wool which keeps sheep warm even in the harsh Scottish winters. The tiny multicoloured flecks you find when you look closely come from the fact that the wool's dyed before being spun into yarn. So what looks like a green will often contain oranges, browns, blues and purples. The workers are brushing and picking any tiny imperfections off a freshly woven length of material. Chatting in Gaelic, their native tongue, many islanders only learn English at school. Being so far from the mainland, the Isles of Harris and Lewis have a strong identity, steeped in their two main traditions, croft farming and Harris Tweed.
I think it's so important that we, as custodians of the orb, as custodians of Harris Tweed, that we make sure it's not going to suffer from the slumps that it has in the past, where it has really and truly, it was on its knees.
Anne McCullum's the chief executive of the Carloway Mill in Lewis. The first woman to run a Harris Tweed mill, she's widely praised for being instrumental in turning the failing industry around and making the fabric more fashionable.
We have to be very proud of the fact that this is a handmade product. It's protected by an Act of Parliament. There's so many unique selling points of this fabric. And we have to make sure that we're selling it in a way that we're not putting all our eggs in one basket. You've seen the process today. You see how much love and care goes into actually making a metre of tweed. And that's something that's very, very different to anything else that's manufactured in the cloth industry. And we need to market that and make sure that when the customer comes to buy a product made of Harris tweed, they really understand why it's the price that it is.
To qualify for the Orb stamp of authentication, Harris tweed has to be handwoven on Harris or Lewis using yarn that's also been dyed and spun on the islands.
I really love it. It's become an obsession with me now. What started off as a retirement hobby is now an obsession. I love it.
Norman Mackenzie grew up in Carloway. As a child, he'd earned pocket money by winding the bobbins for his father and uncle, who were both weavers. After a career as a dentist in Glasgow, he retired back to the Outer Hebrides and rediscovered his passion for the fabric.
All Harris tweed, you're not allowed to make it in the mill or a factory at all. It's got to be done in weaving sheds like this, which are adjacent to where the weaver stays on his croft. So this shed was built about 60 years ago by my uncle. Before that, the loom was in the house, really. It's not the same loom that was in then, but, you know, it's the same kind of loom. But everything else is more or less exactly as it was. The loom's in the same place. The weft winding machine over there is in the same place. And, you know, it's virtually, you know, the way it was.
As well as the tweeds commissioned by the mills, Norman Mackenzie weaves independently and has seen a surge in the fabric's popularity.
They're looking at other markets as well. They're looking at India and Russia and even China, you know, they're looking at these markets. So the potential is really great for the industry just now.
But revamping the image and exploring new markets has highlighted another major challenge to the industry. With mills closing down and orders drying up until just a few years ago, weaving had become more of a nostalgic pastime than an attractive employment opportunity.
It really, the industry is going through a purple patch at the moment, and they're really desperate for new weavers. They are training a few, but they're really desperate for more young people to come forward, and hopefully, you know, young people will come in, because there's a wonderful opportunity now.
I purchased a jacket just the other year.
29-year-old Donald John McKenzie's been weaving tweeds for 4 years. He was one of the youngest participants on a 6-week council-funded training course and now works regularly with one of the 3 operative mills. Originally a joiner by trade, weaving's become his primary source of regular income and an unexpectedly satisfying job.
It's lovely, the time you spend on the croft weaving and just the enjoyment. You're inside in the winter when the weather's bad and you can leave it at your own leisure and pick up on other work that you're trying to catch up on the croft.
The Isles of Harris and Lewis are now offering training programmes to students in schools to encourage them into the industry. And Anne McCullum says its image is rapidly improving.
Yeah, definitely. No question it's changing. It's definitely attracting younger people. It's now seen as an industry which has a future, a long-term future, and that's what you need. You can't bring young people into an industry unless they can see that there's a job in it for a long term.
And if anyone believes Harris tweed has a long, bright future, it's Norman Mackenzie.
200 years Harris tweed has been around in the islands, but yes, I can see it being around quite easily in another 100 years, maybe more.
Danny Mitzman, Deutsche Welle Radio, The Outer Hebrides.
If those last couple of stories weren't enough to remind you what a paradise for fine things of all kinds Europe can be, maybe this one will be more up your street. It's about food. More specifically, it's about the French culture of food that has been such an inspiration for people around the world for centuries. We're not going to take you into the kitchens of the great French chefs in central Paris, though. We're going to go one step closer to the farm, out at the edge of the city, a place which may have played a bigger role than any chef or restaurant in making French cuisine what it is today. It's called Rungis. It's Paris's main food market, and it's actually the biggest food market in the world. Earlier this year, Eleanor Beardsley got the chance to take a tour. I can't wait to hear it again.
It's hard to know where to start when describing the Rungis International Food Market. It's bigger than the Principality of Monaco. It has its own beltway and rail stop. It's equipped with banks, hotels, a truck repair shop, and car rental agencies. Rungis Market is its own city, really, but a city that lives at night. After midnight, trucks begin to roll into Rungis from all corners of Europe. They're loaded with food that was harvested, plucked, shot, or slaughtered, often that very day. From 2 a.m., buyers show up to haggle over the merchandise. Tempers flare, but for the last millennium, the butchers, market vendors, and restaurants of Paris have been doing their shopping like this. Eric Deladoire's family has sold seafood at the Rungis market for three generations.
La gastronomie française vient de ces produits. Donc c'est des produits de qualité.
French gastronomy comes from these products. It's thanks to the fresh, high-quality food here that French cuisine is so savory, delicious, and famous.
The market that is now at Rungis began operating in the year 1110. Up until 1969, it was located in the heart of Paris at a place called Les Halles. Writer Emile Zola described Les Halles as the stomach of Paris. Its atmosphere and hubbub were immortalized by photographers like Henri Cartier-Bresson and captured in songs and films. When the market outgrew its crowded urban quarters in Les Halles, it moved 4 miles out of the city to the village of Rungis. It's the same market, but the name Les Halles remains mythical. 61-year-old fishmonger Jackie Lorenzo, who is buying sea urchins and live crabs for his Paris market stall, remembers the market when it was at Les Halles.
C'était extraordinaire. Alors là, vous voyez, quand les Américains arrivent à Paris, ils demandaient pas la tour.
It was extraordinary. When American tourists came to Paris, they didn't ask to see the Eiffel Tower. They asked to see Les Halles. The atmosphere was formidable.
In giant connecting halls, meats and cheeses, fruits, vegetables and flowers regale every sense. Rungis feeds 11 million people in the Paris region every day, as well as supplying markets and restaurants around the world. Philippe Verral of the company Fayard Gastronomy exports to the U.S. and Asia from Rungis. Verral points out what's available in the poultry and wild game hall.
You have grey partridge, you have red partridge, you have pigeon, you have pheasant, you have venison, you have hare, and you have duck, wild duck.
The boxes full of hares and colorfully plumed pheasants are eye-popping, especially for an American used to saran-wrapped poultry without feet or feathers. Next door, in a giant meat hall, the scene conjures up a 19th-century slaughterhouse. Sides of beef swing by on meat hooks, and men with bloody aprons carry giant carcasses on their shoulders and backs. Another building is set aside exclusively for offal. That's innards, if you're not familiar with the term. Serge Nadeau is a third-generation offal dealer. He stands next to a shelf of cow hearts as big as bowling balls. Thick cows' tongues are laid out beside them. But Nadeau says the French don't eat like they used to. Housewives used to cook up veal head at home, he says. Now people only go out for such dishes.
We used to sell veal liver with sweet bread, with veal head. I sell, but not the same quantity as 10 years before.
Nadeau wheels out a bin of calf heads, which have been scooped out and look more like pale veal masks.
That's what you used to eat, with the cheek here. All this part, with the tongues, on the bone.
Tongues and brains are still selling at Rungis, as they have for 10 centuries. And though the market has lost much of the antiquated inner-city charm of Les Halles, it's still the belly of Paris and a fascinating place to observe one of the world's great food cultures. Eleanor Beardsley, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
Well, when it comes to cuisine, not all countries in Europe are created equal. France, Italy, Spain. You might have your own favorite. I rather think Portuguese food is underrated. But the food of the Netherlands is unlikely to be high on anyone's list. Here's an illustration. They still have automats there, and people love them, enough said. But the Dutch are hoping to lead the way in a new culinary frontier for Europe, that of eating insects. A trade organization there called Vennik has been founded to promote the eating of insects. That might not strike you as an improvement for Holland's cuisine, but ask the right person from countries as diverse as China, South Africa, or Mexico, and they'll tell you just how tasty and filling a creepy critter can be when prepared right. With that in mind, my colleague Helen Sini spoke with Marion Peters, the General Secretary of Vennik, and asked her about the group.
Fennec is the Dutch Breeders Association, and it's not widely spread through the Netherlands. There are only 16 companies working in insect breeding, and we are hoping to expand that by having people eating insects.
So how are you promoting the idea that people should eat insects?
It's so new and it's such a radical innovation that we get a lot of media attention at first. And we are working on this since 2007. And at first, people started to laugh and it was like a fear factor thing. But now in the Netherlands, almost everybody knows you can eat insects. And then there's the second part of the of the deal. People have to try them and to taste them. And that's what we're really doing, letting them taste them, because the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And then the next time eating it, it's not that difficult anymore.
So can people buy these insects in shops and supermarkets, for example?
Not yet in the supermarkets. We sell them to a wholesale supplier who sells them to restaurants, hotels and snack bars. And that's Sligro, and that's wholesale spread over all over the Netherlands. And there's 24 stores.
And how have the Dutch reacted so far?
Some people do still laugh about it and they think, oh, I will never eat that. But there is really a group of more sustainable thinking people. They know that that's good for the environment and that we need other sources of proteins. And they're really interested. But the most interesting part is the youth. They really like it. They think it's adventurous and they're tough when they're eating it.
Obviously, breeding insects is far easier on the environment than raising cattle or growing vegetables. But I believe it's quite expensive to breed insects. Why is that the case?
It's still the case because the labor part of the insect breeding is still big in the cost price. And we're now also thinking of more mechanization and automatization in this process. So it's all new. We're working on the fundamentals of a real new sector. And because it's also a small production, the price is still high. When we can upscale this, prices will lower, we think.
Marion, you obviously like munching on insects. What's your favourite bug and your favourite bug recipe?
My favourite bug recipe is a wok recipe. And I like to put locusts and mealworms in my wok together with vegetables and rice and some soy sauce.
And what would you say to someone who's listening to this interview and feels quite sick at the thought of what you just said?
I would say just try it and then form your opinion afterwards, because it's not that bad. And we know because we tested on many, many people.
Marianne Peters of the insect-eating group Venik. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Welcome back to our year-end edition of Inside Europe. You might have gone home for the holiday season, right? Well, not everyone is so lucky to live close enough to home to fit in a trip. Sometimes you have to do the next best thing, bring a bit of home to wherever you are. Earlier this year, an event of that kind took place on a mass scale, mainland Europe's biggest gathering of ethnic Tamils. They're originally from southern India and Sri Lanka, but thousands of Tamils descended on the town of Kefala, Germany, near the Dutch border for one weekend only. Joanna Impey was there to check it out.
The sound of chanting reverberates over loudspeakers across the main square in the German town of Kevela. Turn the corner behind the church and you see where the sound is coming from. Hundreds of people have congregated for an open-air mass. These pilgrims are some of the thousands of Sri Lankan Tamils who came to Germany and Europe as refugees in the 1980s, fleeing the civil war in their homeland. The first pilgrimage to Kevela was back in 1987, when around 50 people made the journey. In the years since, the numbers have swelled to around 10,000 to 15,000. In the main square, long queues have already formed in front of the Gnadenkapelle, or Chapel of Mercy. The chapel houses one of the main reasons the pilgrims started coming here, the miraculous picture of the Madonna that has brought fame to Kevala. As they file past, some people hold up their children to get a closer look at the tiny copper plate print. Father Bennett Fernando, a Tamil Catholic priest based in Germany and one of the organisers of this year's pilgrimage, explains that the Sri Lankan people make a close connection between the Madonna in Kevala and a similar shrine back home in Madu. In honour of the occasion, they're dressed up in their Sunday best, women in jewel-coloured saris, girls in frilly party dresses, and boys in smart shirts and trousers. Father Bennett Fernando says the reasons for the pilgrimage are social as well as religious.
I think this is time for a people to come together for prayer, where they find inner peace, And also, on the other side, this is the time for the people to, for the social gathering. All the people who had been displaced from Sri Lanka, they live all around in Europe. So this is the, for them an occasion to come together for the celebration.
And these pilgrims emphasize how important family is to them.
My sister's here and my lot of relations are here. And we have to speak some little bit and then enjoy something.
I wanted to participate in this celebration with my relatives. So I came from London with my relatives here.
After the mass has ended, the pilgrims move on to the next important part of the day. Indian and Sri Lankan traders have set up a temporary market behind the Kevala Basilica.
They're all different prices. No, all different prices.
Tell me what you're doing today.
We're selling saris.
And so you have a business in London and you've come all the way out to Germany.
That's right, absolutely. Sorry? This one is 16 euros.
And do you come every year?
No, this is the first time.
And what do you think of it?
It's fantastic.
They're selling so many Indian foods, right? Rolls, vade, and mustard.
Indian Sri Lankan.
Yeah, Sri Lankan also, right?
Sri Lankan food.
Yeah, and some spicy foods as well. Mixer, and bakoda, and some mangoes as well, right?
Between the stalls selling clothes and food, you can find toys and other goods, even small statues of the Hindu god Ganesha, with its distinctive elephant head. That's because a large proportion of the Tamil pilgrims who come to Kevala are Hindu, not Catholic. They worship the Madonna in the same way as their Christian compatriots. Albert Kuhlen, a priest from the Diocese of Aachen, who's been closely involved with the Tamil community in Germany for many years, says all of them are praying for peace in their homeland.
Officially, the war is over since 2 years, but what I told in the church, the war is over, but there's no peace. I know each family who is here today as one of these relations, friends, or honor, who died in this war. This is a very strong feeling. So their feeling is also that the war is not over for them because there's no peace.
Back in the main square in Kevala, peace has descended after the long day. Thousands of candles flicker in the evening light as the pilgrims make their way home to all corners of Europe. Joanna Rimpi, Deutsche Welle Radio, Kevala.
And that's all for this week's edition of Inside Europe. If you want to drop us a line, we're always very happy to hear from you. Our email address is europe@dw-world.de. On behalf of sound engineer Bastian Schick, thanks for listening, and it's goodbye from me, Matt Herman. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.